Good morning. This is Patricia Kohlberg, and I am here today with activist Leslie Gregory. Leslie is a Navy veteran and a physician assistant who is practicing here in Portland. Now, I want to say for listeners who might not know, a physician assistant is a health practitioner, much like a nurse practitioner, who is licensed to independently diagnose and treat medical problems. Leslie Gregory is also at the forefront of the campaign to get racism declared a public health emergency. She is the founder and director of the local nonprofit Right to Health, whose vision is to create a network, a national network of healthcare providers, scientists, and community leaders who are committed to dismantling the effects of racism across all ethnic groups. Hundreds of cities and counties and states across the country have moved to formally declare racism a public health emergency with the intent to direct attention and resources toward anti-racist policies and programs. And this campaign, as you might imagine, has accelerated quite a bit in the context of the current public health crisis of the pandemic and the uprising against racism. Good morning, Leslie Gregory, and welcome to The Old Mole.
Hi, thank you.
The Old Mole recently aired a podcast about the radical public health programs of the Black Panthers. Leslie, you have your own history with the Black Panthers. I'd like to start with your personal story and how the Panthers inspired you.
It's a really great question. I appreciate it. My grandmother, Louise Booker, had one of the first Black-owned businesses in my hometown, and it was centered right in the middle of what was called then the Black community, now what would be known as the hood. And so right at door in Detroit, my grandmother's beauty shop was located, and directly across Door Street was the Black Panther headquarters. At that time, my only real relationship to the Black Panthers was that and driving by it every Saturday to get my hair done. And I was always struck by the facade of the building, which was heavy brick, concrete, a facade with tiny little slits in it. And I always thought, wow, that looks like a bunker. You know, it looks just like the war movies that you saw. And I always thought, what must be on the other side that it would need protection in that way? You know, when all I'd heard about the Black Panthers at that point was that they had started some kindergarten programs, they were doing some feeding of the poor, you know, particularly children, and of course, the pictures that you saw, the berets, you know, the Black berets and the powerful countenance of the fist raised and the proud awareness of Blackness, you know, and that was really my only awareness of their reputation in the community, that they were there to do good and to protect the children.
And your mother was, I believe, a nurse. So tell us a little bit about how you did get involved with the Panthers and with their health programs and what your mother's relationship to the Panthers was.
My mother was a staunch Lutheran. And in fact, she was the first Black nurse to graduate from the St. Vincent Medical School, nursing school, although she'd been turned down the first year just because she was Black. No other reason, because she was very well accomplished in high school. And so for that year that she awaited her second chance to apply, she went to the university there. And there was a mild presence of the Panthers there on the university campus. My mother, I think, saw the model of taking care to the people. And that's how the Black Panthers delivered their care, was to bring care to the people. As a nurse, that's what she did. She started a mobile unit taking care to the people rather than expecting them to come to care.
And did you work in the clinic at all?
Yes, it was a mobile unit, and it went into communities testing at first for sickle cell and then for the components of the metabolic syndrome, cholesterol, sugar, etc. And yes, I was there you know, poking fingers with her and talking to people about their results and changes they need to make. Yes. And that's what my protocol is based on now, currently.
Yes. Well, tell us a little bit more about your vision, not necessarily what you're doing now professionally, but how you see health services, how they should be provided to a community that's long been excluded from mainstream medicine in big ways.
Well, again, I think the issue is to bring the care to the people in their communities where they're more comfortable and feel safer and much more likely to comply, because the people delivering that service will have a much more will appear closer to the community. It will also help to mentor people of color into medicine, because that's how I got into it, was watching my mother and the care she provided. And so that's what my protocol involves, is a mobile unit going into communities at events and cultural events, et cetera, to bring this care to the people and talk to them about how managing chronic diseases can overall reduce risk, including for things like COVID, but also heart disease, diabetes, these sorts of things.
So you see your program as not only bringing services to a community in a way that meets them in their own communities and is sensitive to the kinds of health problems that they face, but is also a space for inspiring people of color to become health professionals.
Right.
And then perhaps also to help organize communities around health issues. Is that part of the vision as well?
Correct. Health issues being in the macro as well as micro terms. So for instance, a mobile unit could bring in reading materials about weight reduction, diabetes, risk management, healthy foods, etc. But it also would talk to the issues of food deserts, bring voting materials so that you're looking big picture as well. Also, what would happen at these events, and again, they can be either organized by the campaign. We could say to them, hey, let's have a health fair, or it can already be at an event like a Juneteenth or a Cinco de Mayo holiday. And the idea would be, instead of bringing patients into the clinic where blood pressure may be factitiously elevated when you're anxious and you don't feel comfortable, actually getting that baseline blood pressure without that sort of stress involved and more accurate. Also, people in their own communities would be able, instead of being worried about patient privacy issues, a lot of times I find people will actually share with each other their results. Oh, look, my triglycerides are a little higher than yours. Oh, look, my total cholesterol is lower than yours. What can we do? Those sorts of community events bring people together to collaborate around health. And that is another way that communities not only become more cohesive for themselves, but may share and help each other be more healthy.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. There is lots of literature to support the notion that communities that are socially cohesive are communities that have better health outcomes.
Absolutely. So for instance, if you have access to an automobile, you can say to your friend, look, I'll go get a big, huge bag of salad, bring it home instead of yours, where it may rot because you haven't had a chance to get the size that is most appropriate for you. As well as, hey, let's walk together. You know, we talk about how to get your good cholesterol up a little bit. How about you walk with me? These are some of the things that we know not only reduce stress and increase safety, a feeling of safety in your communities. If you don't feel comfortable walking alone, hey, let's start a walking group. Like that. So these are ways that we know communities can encourage each other to be more healthy. And that saves everybody, not just money, lives. You know, precious healthcare dollars certainly is always an issue.
One thing you had mentioned to me in an earlier conversation was your sense that for there to be real progress on dismantling racism in this country, the non-minority population needs to see it in their interest. Could you just elaborate a little bit on that idea?
Well, absolutely. You know, the practice that I have here in Oregon, it's largely not affected communities. As you know, there's a very low percentage of people of color here. However, I have had my patients come in and express a great deal of discomfiture at what they're seeing, whether it's the violence in communities or, you know, inequitable treatment, et cetera. And so understanding that this will also reduce the stress, anxiety, what we call cognitive dissonance in majority culture will also help and help people to behave out of what we call enlightened self-interest. Once you realize that there's a lot of waste of your own taxpayer dollars in the mistreatment of others, then you'll begin to say, wow, you know, who's getting all the money from these prisons that perhaps are, you know, inundated with people who don't necessarily need to be there? Who's making that money? Because I'm paying for it. And so this is just a small example, but we know that $2.4 billion a year, and that's a very conservative estimate, that our whole country is paying in health disparities, $2.4 billion. Let's think about what else we could do with that money, because that is not just coming from people of color. And so what we know is enlightened self-interest can also reduce stress in the general population.
I agree with that. And I think there's considerable international epidemiological research that supports the idea that everyone, rich or poor, black, white, or brown, all suffer the adverse effects of a deeply unequal society. Obviously, those who are the targets of racism suffer the most, but the lives of rich white people or middle-class white people are also degraded as well.
Exactly. And also seeing that in the data that white male mortality and morbidity is on the rise, but one would not expect that. And so we have to dial that in too. We have to do our research and find out what's going on there. And I think that may be related.
You're thinking that that is part and parcel of living in a society where the race gaps and the income gaps are getting larger.
Well, and I think there's another gap that people rarely speak about that I think is just as relevant, which is called the empathy gap. That idea that you could never be in the position of the people you're hearing about. The idea that you would think all they had to do is comply. They shouldn't have been doing, you know, fill in the blank. And this idea that, oh, that would never be me. And then when you see this kind of, you know, continuing and escalating violence, it's called cognitive dissonance. When on the one hand, you're thinking, this could never be me. But on the other hand, you're looking at what they're doing and thinking, wow, I don't see what they did wrong there. You know, maybe that could be me. And these are the kinds of mixed messages that our brains find quite stressful. You know, two opposites cannot exist at the same time.
Right. I think the George Floyd video did a lot to dispel or reduce that empathy gap that you're talking about.
And again, when you think about, you know, I'm voting, you know, I'm going to the polls. Is my voice being heard when I go to the polls? And the idea that, you know, no, a lot of people feel disconnected from, you know, their own government. And so, again, that stress just increases. And I believe that you have to think when you're looking at these events constantly happen, what do I call it when I get to do the things that would end someone else's life? What would it be like to be pulled over for a simple moving, speeding, whatever violation in my life versus someone else who may be doing the exact same thing wrong, and yet it may end their life?
Mm-hmm. Leslie, can you give our listeners a way to get involved with your particular campaign? Tell us how they could get in touch with you.
Okay, very simple. I am on social media, so it's very simple to look me up on Facebook, Twitter. This is the place where Right to Health, R-I-G-H-T, to Health, is featured fairly prominently. You can find me there. You can get involved in the campaign by simply going to moveon.org. We have a campaign there that is, you know, you can just type in racism and public health, and you can find our campaign there.
Leslie, thank you very much for talking with me today about the very important anti-racist work that you're doing, and particularly from a public health perspective. Thanks very much. This has been Patricia Kohlberg speaking today with founder and director of Right to Health, local activist Leslie Gregory.